Today we'll conclude our current series on the political philosophy of anarchism. If you missed previous programs, briefly, anarchism is a social, economic, and political movement which largely predates other currently existing radical leftist movements like Marxism, for example. There are many different schools of anarchist thought, but regardless of these differences, all legitimate branches of anarchism share a common commitment to the following four basic principles: individual freedom, social and economic equality, free association, and mutual aid, in other words, cooperation and solidarity. All anarchists seek to create a classless, stateless society free of oppression and exploitation that is organized and held together by those four principles. Since they discovered anarchism following the 1999 Seattle WTO demonstrations, media coverage of anarchists has ranged from alarmist to condescending. None have taken a serious look at the vision of society anarchists are seeking to realize. Instead, most coverage has suggested that anarchists are merely engaged in mindless protest for its own sake. But the reality is that discussions of what a good society looks like and how to begin creating it are on the agenda whenever anarchists gather. Anarchists in cities coast to coast put on annual book fairs, which, in addition to selling books, feature lectures and workshops. For the conclusion of the program, we'll bring you speakers from two such workshops. Our first speaker is Howard Ehrlich, who is a sociologist connected with the Institute for Anarchist Studies. He spoke at the Boston Anarchist Book Fair last year about creating counter-institutions and the anarchist vision of a good society.
Some of you who read Social Anarchism know that we've been running a series on an anarchist agenda, and we've had so far about 12 different writers from about 6 different countries writing about their view of what an anarchist agenda ought to be. And one of the things about that I want to make clear, one of the reasons why we have so many views, is that while I'm making a proposal here, I don't want you to regard it as anything more than a proposal among many other alternative proposals that could have been made. But I am not proposing that we not work up an agenda. That is to say, I think it's really important. We're growing right now as a movement, and it's especially important as a movement that we have some direction in what we're doing, a direction that is not a blueprint. A blueprint is a map to disaster, but rather a sketch, if you will, of where we're going. Because I don't want this to be rigidified. I don't want us to take it in any rigid fashion. And if I sound like I'm being authoritarian or rigid about it, it's only because I don't know how else to express what it is I want to express about this. We need an agenda in order to transform the way in which people think about the possibilities of human society. We need an agenda because we're trying to transform ourselves, if you will, into a new, to use an older rhetoric, post-revolutionary person. We need an agenda because anarchism is attempting to build a new society, challenging the legitimacy of the structures of the old, and in part attempting to model new kinds of structures. We need, in the words of that great politico, a vision thing. We need to have a view of a good society. Again, a theory sketch, not a blueprint. We need to try to act as if we live in that good society. There are those who, following the lead of earlier revolutionists, adopt an essentially guerrilla strategy, claiming that ideology and visions and theory follow from action, follow from those who act. And I have no doubt that in some cases this may be true, but for the most part, action and attitudes, practice and theory are intertwined. In the best of circumstances, each informs the other. Theory without practice is going to self-destruct. Practice without theory is going to self-destruct. And so we've got to continually force ourselves to go back and forth. The subtitle of the magazine is A Journal of Theory and Practice, because that really is our commitment. If sometimes we're a little heavy on theory, at other times we try to do some genuine how-to-do-it stuff in it. The two have got to go together. Our primary task right now, I think, is to create anarchists. That is to say, we're building towards an anarchist movement. There are still too few of us to do the work that needs to be done. And that means that as successful as this fair is, with all the people who've come, we ought to be able to double the size wherever we go. In Baltimore, a city even smaller than this, we had maybe 400 people turn out at our first fair. And I hope in the next in a couple of months, we'll have even more. But that means, you know, in the 60s, we used to talk about turning people off as fast as we turned them on. And I think we have to worry about that. That when we engage in a demonstration, if we haven't planned for the day after, we haven't planned very well. The purpose is not merely to make a protest, not merely to offer resistance, which is, you know, a primary purpose of demonstration, but it's also to get people involved in building a movement which is going to take place the day after. And so that has to be a part of what we're doing. There are genuine obstacles to organizing, and I want to mention some of them, because learning those obstacles and learning how to deal with them is part of our agenda. I call one, and I hope nobody takes offense at this, social AIDS, A-I-D-S, which is an acronym for alienation, ignorance, denial, and self-rejection. Now, I called it that because I could make a fancy acronym out of it. But understand that most of the people we're dealing with are just totally alienated from the society. And, well, they should be. But the difference between us and them, if you will, is that we were able to channel our energies into something, whereas most people who are alienated in the sense that they cannot mobilize their energies. And that's part of the obstacles we're dealing with. Constantly we meet people, for example, if we ask them to write, if we ask them to talk on radio, if we ask them to engage in help teach others, they say to us, I can't do that. I've asked some of the most talented people I know to do things, and they will say to me, I can't do that. That is, the level of self-alienation is so great. And it comes, by the way, and I'll go to the S and the AIDS, from self-rejection. Understand that part of the power of the capitalist system is teaching us how to reject ourselves. The major industry in this country is in large measure advertising. And advertising is most advertising is based on the principle that you're no good. It's based on selling you the fact that you stink. It's based on selling you the fact that you drive the wrong car, you drink the wrong beer, you use the wrong shampoo, and that you will be a better person, of course, if you use their products. But the outcome of it isn't just consumerism. The outcome of it is to get people to reject themselves. And if you can get people to reject themselves, then a number of consequences follow, one of which is the search for somebody who's going to tell them which way to go. And so part of what we have to do is, in our agenda, when we talk about empowering people, I think it seems to me, and I reflect a training which I'll confess to as a sociologist and a social psychologist, but we've got to move people to the point where they can accept themselves, and you can only do this in a supportive environment. That is, we provide a new social network, a new social support group for people. Ignorance was another one of the obstacles. I avoided using this notion because it sounded so damned elitist to go around and say that people are ignorant. By ignorant, I mean political ignorance. I don't mean the fact that 42% of a national sample, I'm not making this up, said that oatmeal is made from wheat. I mean, that granted, that's ignorance, but that's not the kind of ignorance I'm talking about. I'm talking about the level of political ignorance that people don't know which side the United States supported in the Nicaraguan War. Now, as one of those who was organizing then, how do you organize people if they think that the United States is on the side of the Contras? People don't know anything at all anymore about nuclear power and nuclear weaponry. How do you organize people against the relicensing of nuclear power plants when they no longer have any absolute... Not only that, but I used to wear a button that said no nukes, which I thought was perfectly self-explanatory, until I had people ask me, what's nukies? And I realized that what I thought was a great conversation starter, you know, and a means of engaging somebody in dialogue, turned out to be my misconception of where people were politically. And that's part of what we have to be able to find out. And finally, in that AIDS syndrome, is denial. You see it especially in the area of race and ethnic relations. A total denial of the status of ethnic minorities in the United States. A total denial. For example, how many of you know that the federal budget, this great new federal budget, cut every civil rights agency, EEOC, Civil Rights, Community Relations Service, you know, however Mickey Mouse they may be in some respects, they cut their budget by 20%. Or that someone like Clinton can get on the air and say that he isn't quite sure we can do anything, but we ought to try, but the fact is that prejudice is innate. I mean, if you believe that prejudice is innate, then there's no longer anything you can do. And when the elites say that, they're clearly persuading a lot of people. A second obstacle, I think, resides in the celebrity process that's so common among many activists. That is, there's a tendency to to glamorize the victims of capitalism. I mean, we need to help the victims of capitalism because we're decent human beings. But to make somebody glamorous because they're starving, to make somebody glamorous because they're in prison, is in fact to miss the point of what we ought to be doing about. 60% of a national survey said they were willing to give up, I'm quoting, they were willing to give up some of the liberties we have in this country in order to crack down on terrorism. 60%, 3 out of 5, willing to give up some of the liberties. Now, we may think we have fewer liberties than they do, but they're willing to give them up. That's part of the internalized oppression. The issue is, how do we cultivate the habits of freedom? And understand that freedom is something that has to be learned. You can't free people. You can liberate them from the confines of a prison. You can liberate them from other kinds of chains. But freedom itself has to be learned. And it has to become a habit. And unless it becomes a habitual mode of behavior, then we all fail as anarchists. Let's acknowledge, and I'm just going to repeat what I started out with, and incidentally, I'm going to try to finish up in about 10 more minutes or so that we can have lots of time for discussion, which I'd much prefer to do than just talk at you. But I want to, again, tell you, there is no one way to engage in a revolutionary project. That we need to ground our vision in a good society. We need to keep evaluating ourselves to see that we're walking on the right path and that you disagree with me all you want, but make it as A, an intellectual argument, and B, don't call me names. There's too much of that going on, I think, within the movement itself and on some of the email exchanges that I see. On my agenda, I think we need an anarchist sociology and we need an anarchist economics. We need to get an anarchist perspective recognized in the academy. Now, You may have rejected the university, you may be out of it, you may be going into it, but understand that there are over 25 million people now in colleges and universities around the country, and that in terms of organizing, it is as legitimate to organize these people as it is to organize people in the workplace or in the community. And it's probably easier to organize on a campus. That's not an argument for focusing all of your energy there, but it is an argument for not neglecting college campuses. And what we need to have on the campus, there is no anarchist sociology. Anarchist writers are not quoted, are not cited in the books on the history of social thought. Literally, not at all. And what is an anarchist economics? That is, if we're agreed, and we are, that we want to uproot and replace capitalism with some other mode of exchange, what is that other mode of exchange that we want? Is there a possibility for some kind of, you know, new form of mixed market? Is there a capitalism without the exploitation of people? I don't think so, but I'm willing to listen to people, you know, make some argument. That is, how are we going to handle money? Are we going to have money? How are we going to handle exchange in what size communities? Is there an optimum size for a human community? Can a Boston or a Baltimore, a Chicago, exist in an anarchist society? Are they beyond what Kirk Sale called human scale? In his book, Human Scale, Kirkpatrick Sale says, probably cities over 100,000 are too big. Because what he does is he plots all the pathologies that can happen in urban areas, and he finds that once you go above 100,000, the pathologies start skyrocketing, going way off the curve. These are the kinds of considerations that I want to be seen among anarchist sociologists. There are at least three of them here, among anarchist economics. We need to identify the strategic sites for anarchist research and action. How do we know we're doing the right thing? That is, when we stage a demonstration, maybe we need movement market research, if that's an appropriate label. That is, how do we know what impact we're having on people? That it's fine to do it for ourselves. Don't sell that short. I think that it's, we must, I reject the arguments of preaching to the choir. It's important that we continue to talk among ourselves, because we don't learn everything all the time. We forget things that we've learned. And sometimes we just need to see that there's some level of solidarity, that there are a lot of people out there who believe the way we do. But what's the effect that we're having on other people? What's the effect we want to have on other people? And I think that's part of, I take that as part of my challenge as a writer and as a one-time sociologist. What about all of the ethnic wars going on in the world? How are we going to handle the situation of ethnic nationalism for liberation movements? How are we going to cope with the fact that the gap between black and white in the United States is so great that we have this enormous difficulty, even in the most egalitarian movement there is, namely the anarchist movement, we have this enormous difficulty in bridging that gap. And how can we do it? I'll talk about that a little, because this is an area in which I do a lot of work.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
We need next on my agenda to build community. Recruitment is hard work. It's usually something, building community is something that's not as valued as much as doing things that have a little more panache to them. You know, making your own video program, doing some building some creative disorder, there's some fun to that. Building community seems like an ordinary sorts of things, but I think it's part of our substantive mission that we need to be concerned with how we build communes and collective households, how we develop the supporting institutions that are vital. We need to figure out how to deal with the life cycle gap. At the New England a conference in Plainfield, one of the most popular workshops that we had was a workshop on anarchists and their children. Yeah. How do we handle people who are in that, you know, life cycle of having young children? What arrangements are we making for the care of children and for play with children and bringing them to our meetings? And at the same time, what about the older anarchists who would participate but who maybe because of age or infirmity or so on can't quite make the meetings? In what sense are we taking some responsibility and looking out for them? I think recognizing these life cycle and age differences are very important. Of course, as I get older, although I'm still mobile, but if you want to pick me up, I'll be glad to accept a ride. I think we have to go back to the notion of alternative and counter institutions. For those of you who have seen Outlook, I have an article in the first issue of Outlook, the Gainesville anarchist paper, on the process of building counter institutions. A counter institution has to be an institution which is clearly offering an alternative to the existing institution, but more than that. That is, if you build a food co-op, which all it does, and this is no small feat, but which all it does is feed the membership, I would argue that's not enough. And in part, the failure of the counter-institutions, of the many of them, that were built in the 60s, the failure of them resided in the fact that they didn't take the next steps. And one of those steps is that as a counter-institution, you always have to be in resistance and opposition to the institutions that you were built to replace. So it's not enough just to have a food co-op, but you have to be engaged in some set of activities, presumably around food, which is the area you chose to work in. You have to be engaged in some set of activities which exposes the issue of genetically modified foods or genetically modified substances, food irradiation. You have to be able to attack the major supermarkets through various strategies that are carrying these kinds of foods in your community. And you have to be able to engage in some level of nutrition education for all of those people in the community who are going to come and buy from you. And those are part of building a full counter-institution. But you got to do one more thing. And this is the greatest point of failure, I think. You have to engage in internal education. And internal education has two forms. One is you got to teach the people who come to work in the institution about the nature of the institution itself. So they have to learn something about the food distribution system. They have to learn something about big agriculture. They have to learn something about food irradiation and so on and so forth. But they also have to learn the process of working in an anarchist fashion. They have to learn what collective decision-making means. We all have to learn what it means. We have to learn what it means to resolve conflicts. We have to learn what it means to prevent hierarchies from developing within the institutions that we build. These are not simple or easy things to do because we've all been socialized into a hierarchical system. I find that when I do community organizing, which I've been doing for the last couple of years, that one of the things that we have to deal with is the fact that most people in the community can't sit down at the table and have a civil meeting. It is no time at all before, unless you can control the meeting, it's no time at all before people are insulting each other, questioning the integrity of each other, or using forms of verbal aggression which are not really very apparent unless you study what's going on in some way. The idea of an alternative institution, counter institution, appeals to a lot of people. This is heavy political work. Now, it holds true whether you're building a radio collective. Linda Pinkow talked earlier today about building one here in Boston around WMBR. And no censorship radio. It's true whether you're doing radio, it's true whether you have a bookstore, it's true whether you have a food co-op or what have you. That these basic principles are critical, I think, on our agenda. The next item on my agenda I call survival skills, and that entails a lot of problems and questions. How do we support ourselves? That's a question I'm sure a lot of you have asked. I'm certainly asking, having just losing about half my income. What kinds of jobs can we take, you know, within a capitalist society in which we don't sell ourselves out? How can we support members of our collective or commune? Is it necessary for everyone to have to slave away at a capitalist job? Are there some ways in which we can build alternative economic systems, trading systems, labor exchanges, so as to minimize our effort? For almost 20 years, I was able to live in a communal setting in which my total expenses for rent were $15 a month. That meant, it's a little higher now, but that meant that I was free not to go into the capitalist marketplace to sell myself, because I didn't need that much money to live well in the setting in which I lived. Because other members of our collective household agreed that they would pay more in order to enable me and others, in fact we rotated on this, in order to pay me and others to do political work. We've got to place mutual aid on our agenda. We've got to develop organizational forms for its provision. And this includes our needs for nonviolent defense, and includes means of supporting people who get caught up in state repression. It doesn't mean organizing legal teams the day after, but rather of having these systems in place to fight back long before. A couple more points before I close. And one is the issue of diversity. Now, a lot of people want to stay within an anarchist enclave and to live and work out their lives there. And I think that's great, and I think they ought to be encouraged. But if we build community, our community is going to be strongest, just as in an ecological setting where we have greater diversity. And I think that that diversity has to be with regard to gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, and skin color. There is a necessity, I think, for our survival in diversity. And a serious commitment to diversity has to include an active opposition to white supremacist groups, to theocratic groups, to fascist groups as well. And the question then comes up is, how do we start moving, if you will, in those circles? And one of the important things we need to consider is to consider two dimensions of American intergroup relations that oppress people. One is the issue of discrimination. Now, lots of us here have been victims of discrimination because of appearance or politics. But it's not quite the same as being victimized because of gender, sexual orientation, or skin color. And fighting against discrimination, for all people, is one of the ways in which we move a step closer to communities of color. And I know, and I don't mean this as an insult, but I know of very few anarchist groups which are actively engaged in anti-racist programming, ARA notwithstanding, in many communities. And fighting diversity is one way of fighting discrimination. If you talk long enough, you say really dumb things. Fighting discrimination is one of the ways to do it. At the same time, we have to fight against the kinds of random violence in the community. The reason why, I come from a city in which, even though it's only 600,000 people, there are more murders per capita than New York. There are literally more random shootings in Baltimore than in any other city in the country. And people and people in many neighborhoods, including mine, are frightened to go out. They close down at night. Call the police for some incident, and they arrive maybe. And when they arrive, they insult the people who called them. We have to find means of dealing with not just corrupt cops and cop watches. We have to find ways of dealing with violence in the community. Violence is a tool of oppression. That is, it may have other meanings and other, you know, it may redound in the community in other ways, but it really, the reason why violence persists in our communities, because it is in the interests of the political elites. Because it scares the hell out of people, it keeps them apart. And so I would argue, and discrimination plus plus violence leads to ethno-violence. That is, it takes the two of them to lead to prejudice-motivated attacks, to what some people call hate crimes. And that's the way we begin building some of our bridges to communities of color and other people. I need to say two final things. One is, the last item on my agenda is in anarchist media. We must seriously be concerned with building an anarchist community media. You can travel through most cities and see or hear no signs of an anarchist movement. Any of you who've traveled, you know, from city to city, know if you don't have a contact, how hard it often is to find out where. You may learn of a neighborhood and hope that there's some place where there's a flyer somewhere in a laundromat or in some bookstore or something like that. Groups in every city should have a website. There should be an anarchist center presenting cultural and educational programs. We have a great anarchist radio program in Boston, but that's only one. In a city this size, there should be what? 4, 5, 6, a whole day's worth of anarchist programming. And that doesn't mean a low power station that goes for 4 blocks. That may be fun, but I don't think for myself that I want to work on a 4 block radio station. If we can have remotes in 25 parts of the city at the same time, that's a different story, and technically feasible. Radio programs, television programs via the web are here already, and we ought to be working on those as well. There ought to be an anarchist newspaper, a street sheet in every city. That is, it's through building a media that we begin to get the word out that goes beyond our own community, so that some of the media are for ourselves and some of the media for outreach. But this is critical. Let me close by saying that I think there are some stages in revolutionary organizing. One is a stage of cultural preparation. It's basic political education. And these go on simultaneously because people are at different levels in all these stages. For everyone here, you've already passed that stage. You've already had that basic political education, that basic anarchist cultural preparation. But for most of the people you see and deal with every day, they haven't. And so that's part of our job, is engaging them in that. We have to go about building organizational strength. Now, by building organizational strength, it has to be done on an anarchist model. I don't mean some centralized organization, you know, in which we all come together with a psychopomp and a sociopomp and assorted committee chairs. But a movement maybe in which we're a genuine network, a set of overlapping social circles, if you will, in which there are some people who can move across those circles. And then when things come down, when a demonstration is called for or needed, when some defense is needed, those members of those circles can all come together. It's something like a guerrilla model, but not quite. But however it comes to be organized, if we're going to have strength, we've got to be able to come together. The next stage, it seems to me, is the stage of resistance, that if we begin resistance too early, we're going to be crushed too easily. so that once we have that organizational strength, we're ready seriously to begin to talk about resistance. And part of that resistance is the building, my next stage, if you will, of counter and alternative institutions. That's where our strength is going to be. And at that point, we're ready for total political and economic non-cooperation. At that point, we're ready to delegitimize the state, if you will. I subscribe to the Big Bang theory of revolution, which theory is that if you can delegitimize those in power, then they deflate. If we have that political and economic organization in place, we're there. Now, one experiment I became involved in was an experiment ongoing in sort of, to use a term from another sort of domain, libertarian municipalism. A group of people, mainly liberals, got together and persuaded the electorate of a 15-block area in which I live in Baltimore to agree to a surtax. That is, for people who own property or own businesses, they paid another $50 to $100, which was collected by the city through the state, so that you wind up in some weird manner relating to the city. But you also wind up with $350,000 to $400,000 a year. Now, you want to talk about a community organizing project. Here's community organizing with a budget. And here is an accepted means. Now, if everybody involved in it had been explicitly anarchist, I'm sure the powers that are in the city would have crushed it instantly. There have been several anarchists involved. I will tell you that we failed in many ways to really build on this. But we learned a great deal about building alternatives that were self-funding. Now, this thing is going to come to a sunshine vote in another year or two, and we'll probably fight against it or use a fight against it as a means of getting the people to change it. The governance of this district comes from the civic associations, the block clubs and the multi-block clubs. And there are, in that neighborhood, many, many anarchists. There are several well-known collectives who live in that neighborhood, who, if they became part of that pressure, and that's where I think the two anarchists, myself and another, were in it, failed, if they became part of that pressure, could, in fact, redirect that money in terms of genuine, you know, bottom-up organizing with a budget to do it. So that's one way I'm really looking at, not using, and this model, by the way, is catching on all over the country now. There are already two now in Baltimore. There'll be more coming, and other cities are trying to latch on to it. It's very tricky, but it's a form of organizing that I think we can get into. The other things, they're all labor-intensive stuff. There's no question. And in fact, it's our labor, not our money, that gets them going. There are ways in which we can deal with it. And I think labor trades, alternative money systems, which probably will work better in smaller towns, you know, than in bigger towns. That's just a guess. But the places where it's worked best have been small communities as opposed to large cities. And it's worth trying. Exchanges are easy. There's software for labor exchange systems, so that everybody doesn't have to go out and reinvent things. And a labor exchange system can bring in all kinds of people. I'm doing some work now in exchange for a sort of political contractor coming in to do something in my house. So I think that, you know, that's another thing. When we talk about, say, a food co-op, it's also a way of getting food more cheaply. We ought to be able to get up to maybe as high as a 20% discount for people who work within the co-op itself. If you save 20% on your food bill, you're saving, you know, a nice chunk of change. So there are ways in which, in fact, we don't have to really, cut down on our living style, but eating the kinds of foods we want to eat, but we have to expend more energy maybe in doing it. Well, you know, there were for a number of years so-called radical community chess, in which members of, you know, political communities agreed when they purchased something to put, you know, 3% to 4% in a pot. So instead of, you know, paying a sales tax to the state, they were, you know, they agreed to self-taxes and raise money to do that. The thing that makes a difference is the commitment to a non-hierarchical, non-authoritarian structure, and to the helping people learn how to coexist in that kind of setting. That is not true of when we think of standard institutions in society. This is an institution, the reason why it's a counter or an alternative institution, because it's built on a different model of organization, an anarchist model.
That was Howard Ehrlich speaking last year at the Boston Anarchist Book Fair. Recently, anarchists have been focusing their attention on the issues of race and culture. A workshop on anti-racism was held at the Anarchist Book Fair in Montreal last month. We're bringing you the introductory remarks of the three facilitators, Helen, James, and Jaggy. They address the meaning of anti-racism in an anarchist context and the question of cultural identity, nationalism, and diversity. The presentation you will hear was followed by a lively group discussion from a multi-ethnic audience. Unfortunately, we weren't able to record that portion, but this will give you a sense of the way anarchists are approaching these issues.
My name's Helen. This is James and Jaggy. The structure of our workshop is pretty straightforward. We'll just go through it for a little bit. We've got some thematic questions, which Jaggy's written up on the board, and that's going to be the basis for our discussion. That's what we want to take us all through today. So our little presentations are going to be just each of our own reflections on these questions, and then from there we're going to open it up and we can all as a group reflect on these questions and try and, you know, maybe answer them to whatever extent is possible, debate them, what have you. But before doing that, we wanted to give sort of an introduction of where we're coming from. You can call that our starting assumptions, our basis of unity, our platform, whatever you want to call it. But what we're trying to do here by giving this introduction is just sort of frame the discussion a bit. The stuff in this introduction that I'm about to give sort of defines where we're coming from, and we don't really want to debate that starting point. We're not here to argue those basics. So, you know, if there's anything that people like wildly disagree with in that intro, then, you know, obviously we can come up with a way of handling that. So, firstly, by way of this introduction, the three of us here, we're all involved in anarchist organizing. We all believe that both capitalism and the state are inherently coercive, oppressive institutions that have to be dismantled. And we're working on doing that in our organizing that the three of us do and in our daily lives. So that's one part. Clearly, as you can see, we're all people of color and we're all anti-racist activists. So we wanted to note that so often in the face of racism, like the liberal response to that is to like add some color or put some black or brown faces in high places. And this is not why we're here. We don't want to be like the, like, you know, ethnic content of the Anarchist Book Fair or anything like that. It's not our intention to be a Benetton ad for the revolution. That's not what this workshop's about. A more racially and ethnically diverse, and even the word diverse has become like a buzzword in sort of like multicultural, you know, international week against racism type of circles. A more racially or ethnically diverse anarchist movement may or may not be an indication of its relevance to people, but it's not an end in and of itself. So again, that's not why we're here. So let's put this idea of race and racism into its historical context. A key element of the capitalist system is the drive to accumulate wealth, right? And in order to do that, there's a drive to expand the territory and the population under control of the capitalists of a given region. To see this another way, the bourgeoisie of a particular country, of one country, colonizes another in search of new resources, new labor, new markets to concentrate wealth into its hands. So colonialism, as it's been going on for 500 years or so, and as it continues today, has been anything but like an abstract economic concept, as I just framed it, for a great many people, from the transatlantic slave trade to police racial profiling today, from the smallpox blankets to Gustafson Lake. And these are like relatively local examples. There's obviously a lot of examples, both contemporary and historical, that I could use. The forces and the tactics of colonization have been and are brutally and genocidally repressive and dehumanizing. You know, and again, that the contents of that could be a workshop in and of itself. And out of this process of colonialism, we have the concept of race as we know it today and as it operates today. Imperialism is only possible if you can count on the people of the colonizing country, the working class, like the people. Out of this process of colonialism, we have the concept of race as we know it today and as it operates today. Imperialism is only possible if you can count on the people of the country as well as the rulers of the country, so the working class, the proletariat, to identify with their masters, the colonizing bourgeoisie, rather than with the people of the colonizing country. And this happens through like concrete processes of manufacturing a dominant race. So, okay, we as the people in like colonizing country X are all a race. We're all, you know, in this together. That process happens through, you know, the indoctrination processes that take place in all realms of society, the school system, the church, the family, various social structures, both formal and informal, the media. And this made-up idea of race is as fluid or as rigid as capitalism needs it to be. Just as an example of that, less than a century ago, the Irish were not considered to be white. Again, you know, could be a whole separate talk. Ireland today is still very much a colony of England, of Britain. However, at the same time, Irish emigrants here to North America were actively recruited into the so-called white race. And by this, I mean assimilated into becoming like white North Americans rather than being ostracized as outsiders. Although I should mention, I should note that like this happened only after some major waves of Irish emigration to North America had occurred, and there was still a definite period where Irish immigrants were not accepted, channeled into poor neighborhoods, less well-paying jobs, subjected to slurs and everything else that we would recognize as racism. Now, I want to emphasize that this process of like becoming white, for want of a better word, is something that happens to a whole group of people on the basis of language, of culture. It doesn't happen on an individual level. Like I've heard it said, okay, I don't believe in racism, I'm not white or I'm not black, I'm just a person. And I want to dispel that. Like I want to emphasize that that's like a social, historical process where society, the state, defines, you know, who's white and who's not. It's not something you like choose on an individual level. It's like thrust upon all of us. On the other end of things, in this creation of races, colonization dominates people mentally as well as physically through all the same processes of indoctrination that I just mentioned and also through the brutal physical violence of colonization itself. Colonized people historically and today are kept in an inferior position through mental shackles as well as the physical and economic ones. So the idea of a dominant white race and various colonized races, be they black, yellow, brown, however you want to define them, red, is central to maintaining imperialism, which is a cornerstone of capitalism, and which is a function of the state under capitalism. It's very closely tied to class, but it's not exactly the same thing, and it doesn't play out exactly the same way on the ground, like in our daily lives. The vast majority of working class people on a global scale are people of color, and the world's ruling elite is a white one. Race, or more accurately, racism, as a form of social control, is how much of the world's proletariat experiences class. But it's obviously more complex than that. White workers obviously exist, probably some of you are them. And furthermore, white workers are pitted against workers of color, told, for example, that immigrants are stealing your jobs, whipped up into a racist frenzy either to vent their own frustrations against their own repression or to act as a buffer for the ruling class. At the same time, ruling elites in a large number of states today are people of color, the national bourgeoisie of countries that are now or were formal colonies and states that are like independent in name but are under the heel of, say, U.S. imperialism or under the heel of their former colonizing countries. So, you know, these people, the national bourgeoisies of like various countries that are people of color, they're by no means running the world. Like they're still subjected to racism in the world system, but they're definitely not the proletarians either. They're aiding and abetting the functioning of capitalism, and they're running states, they're not our allies. But at the same time, on a global level, they're being dominated by racism with very different results than workers being dominated by racism. Like, for example, Amadou Diallo and Saddam Hussein are not, you know, treated the same way. That fact of racism is not the same for both of them. So the point of all that being, race and class are very different, but they do go hand in hand. We want to destroy class. Like, if we as anarchists are working for a classless free society, then fighting racism, dismantling it today in our daily lives in concrete terms, and obliterating it through the process of revolution should be central, and we believe is central to the project of anarchism. So that's sort of our starting point. That's like our platform. And now I guess I'm going to hand it over to James, and he's going to start us off in thinking about these questions that we have behind us.
Thanks, Helen. Now what's going to happen is that we're all going to go through and present some of our own reflections on these two questions that you see on the board. With regards to the first one, I see a couple points in that question which I feel can be interpreted a bit loosely. So I'm going to try and sort of define it a bit more rigorously so I can present exactly how I'm going to answer the first question. When it says, what does it mean in practice to be, quote, anti-racist and anarchist, I'd just like to reemphasize a bit more the links between the two ideas, anarchism and anti-racism. And I'd like to sort of point out that I see a lot of anarchist organization being centered around ideas of class and socialist ideas, ideas of class hierarchy. But if anarchism, as I see it, is that school of thought which struggles against all forms of authority, and class hierarchies and class authorities aren't necessarily the only forms of authority in our society. They're also racial authorities. So just given that, I'm sort of coming from this perspective, given that anarchism and anti-racism are inextricably linked, what does being an anarchist actually entail from an anti-racist perspective? Whereas, as I said, a lot of anarchist theory and anarchist organization thinks about a socialist perspective or a class-based perspective. Not that their entire classism, class and race are, I mean, they're also linked as well. The first thing that it means to be anarchist from an anti-racist perspective, of course, is to have a good, comprehensive anti-racist analysis. And once again, I'm going to point out that sort of I would sort of venture to say that anarchism is not a merely political idea. And, I mean, people will answer that everything is political. But let me just sort of elaborate on that. As I said, I see anarchism as a school of thought which looks at the social organizations of society and looks at the social interactions and sees relationships of authority and wishes to break down those social authoritarian relationships. In that regard, I view anarchism as more of a mentality, really, than any sort of political doctrine. Politics being all about the control of power and the flow of authority in our society, anarchism or the anarchist mentality can easily be applied to politics, and of course it mostly is applied to politics, but it isn't necessarily entirely political. From this perspective, I'd like to point out that to be an anti-racist anarchist, I don't think it will necessarily do to talk about how the state oppresses people of color or how capitalism oppresses people of color. I think a much broader anti-racist analysis is needed. One needs to look, as Helen mentioned, one needs to look at colonialism, one needs to look at all forms of racial hierarchy and racial authority in our society and have a good analysis of that. That's the first thing that's needed to be an anarchist and an anti-racist in practice. An analysis isn't good without action. I'd like to point out that when one thinks about anti-racist action, an anarchist has to be involved in anti-racist struggles everywhere, breaking down forms of racial authority, racial stratification. in our society, which may not necessarily be that closely related to capitalism or the state. Additionally, however, in anarchist organization, there needs to be a conscious effort to break down racially based forms of authority within our own organizations. Being, as we all are, members and to some degree participants in racist society, we have certain internal mechanisms which reflect the racial stratifications within our society. And when we as a group choose to organize socially or politically, these internal mechanisms will act to construct, to some degree, the same racial stratifications extant within our society, within our own smaller organizations. From that perspective, it's then necessary to recognize, well, first of all, recognize that authority and ensure that within our own organization, it's broken down as much as possible. Within anarchist organization, to a great extent, I already see mechanisms of interaction or rules of interaction, so to speak, which ensure that more general social hierarchies or individual hierarchies don't come about, such as notions, methods of facilitation and speaking rights and consensus-based models of decision-making. But to me, it won't do to just think of individual hierarchies within anarchist organization on a generic level. One has to think about specifically racist and sexist stratification within our organizations. For example, when talking about facilitation, it won't do to just have a conscious, be conscious of individuals and how much space they're taking in a room and so forth. It's also necessary to have a consciousness of how many people of color are speaking or how many women are speaking or which ideas are being considered, whose ideas are being considered more than others, whoever's ideas are being taken, being considered more seriously and things like that. So what I'm getting at is there has to be race consciousness within our methods of organization as well as solidarity with anti-racist struggles. To answer the second question, how does one assert a distinct cultural identity while maintaining anti-authoritarian ideals? One can talk at length about that. There's all sorts of things that can be talked about. I'm going to just talk briefly about nationalism and concepts of nationalism. A lot of anarchists, I find, tend to associate assertion of cultural identity with nationalism and assert nationalism with as a tool of the state, which to a great extent it is. But I just like to draw attention that to the fact that, I mean, so long, like I want to differentiate between the assertion of cultural identity and nationalism. And so long as cultural identity is not being used as a tool of the state, it's not being used as a tool of oppression. I mean, cultural identity can even be a tool that's against oppression. For example, when in an imperialist situation, cultural identity can often be used as a rallying point when it's a matter of one culture or one race pressing another. Race consciousness, just as class consciousness can be used as a rallying point in class struggles, race consciousness can be used as a rallying point in anti-imperialist struggles. And one way of raising race consciousness is through assertion of cultural identities. And I'll just end there.
Okay, so I'm supposed to address these questions as well, and then Helen, and then all of you. So I'm going to try to be brief. I've been mulling around in my head these questions for a few years, and more deliberately in the last year or so, and especially in the last few days, in trying to think about this workshop. And I have to be really honest to say that there's no easy answers that I can really present. I don't want to pretend to present answers to any of these questions. I'd rather present some anecdotes, some feelings I have about this subject. The tough one. I like to talk about problems for anarchists when addressing these issues. And they've been alluded to already. There's the problem of nationalism. Anarchists are opposed to states and the idea of nationalism because that sort of incarnates coercion and authority and leads to police forces and the state and prisons and chauvinism and sort of an identity that asserts itself by pissing on others. Well, as it so happens, nationalism has been a potent progressive force very recently, and especially for people of color, because they've been fighting for their identity because of this historical phenomena that we can't deny of imperialism and colonialism. That's a problem for anarchists. There's the problem of national liberation, that people's liberation, their idea of having a sense of self-worth, and it happens even today in Palestine, in East Timor, it's identified with a type of nationalism that identifies with symbols like flags, etc., etc. There's the problem of race. As Helen was mentioning, race is this construct. It's an imperialistic construct to divide, to create particular classes of people who are of a different color than white. But at the same, so we want to abolish that idea. But at the same time, it's this idea of race is linked in some interesting ways to the idea of cultural identity. So we want to abolish race, but at the same time, we don't want to live in this monolithic culture where we all identify with being, say, white, which is the imagery we get from media, etc. And then, of course, the problem for anarchists is that anarchism itself is identified as being very white and very middle class. And I won't talk about the class part of it, because that's not the scope of, although it fits in with race, but those are problems. And I experienced that firsthand when I went to India for 4 months very recently. My parents are from India, and I'm Indian. I was hoping to write an article called Anarchism in India, and it should really be called Looking for Anarchism in India, because I think India is an example, maybe a case study of how we can apply these questions to other contexts, even immigrant contexts here in North America. It wasn't a relevant ideology. It was marginal. Those are probably familiar things to anarchists in general, but it was particularly the case in India. But also there was this sort of feeling of, this is something to fool around. It took many years of struggle, many deaths, etc., to assert a basic national identity, that is India or Indonesian or whatever, right? Chinese. The ways in which anarchist ideas were being expressed was to question those things, to question heroes of struggles, etc., to say that Gandhi wasn't as great as we thought because, look, he was coercive, etc., to say that, well, the Indian liberation struggle was wrapped up in nationalism and coercion and etc. So, I mean, what did I find, right? I mean, I can't pretend that my 4 months in India was conclusive and I didn't see a lot, but I found individuals that were very sympathetic to this idea, but it had no mass feeling, mass force, and didn't seem to be really, it didn't seem that it could go anywhere in that context. It wasn't speaking to people's realities. One anarchist, and there are anarchists in India, one anarchist I talked to talked about the straitjacket of Marxism or communism, the fact that most left movements in countries like India, and this applies to other third world countries, identify with communism because it was identifying with people's day-to-day reality, how to put food on the table, how to take care of your kids, how to get a better living. And anarchism in the Indian context seemed to be a diversion for the middle class, for people who, you know, might have been on the internet or have traveled and come back and talked about these ideas. I'm talking a bit about a caricature, which is offered me to do because I've been fighting for years, you know, through a variety of different activist activities to try to get beyond this caricature. But I guess what I could say about the Indian context was that, like here, we're a group of schools, we're small groups, and it's marginal. It's not speaking to people's day-to-day reality. I want to, as I said, I'm not going to answer these questions directly, so I want to sort of go into the second topic a bit. I mean, for me, my definition of anarchism is a clear opposition to any form of coercion or chauvinism, to promote values of direct democracy, participatory democracy, empowerment, mutual aid, solidarity. We can flush out these words, but, you know, and do that in a very uncompromising fashion, which makes us marginal because we refuse to accept compromises that the society offers. But by the same token, while I believe in those things, I come from a very specific context, and we all do. I have a mother and father that have certain cultural values, come from a particular culture. I don't want to, and I really kind of shy away from this idea that there's just one amorphous proletarian culture, period, which when often you flush it out, tends to be just a white proletarian working class culture. There are multiple cultures, and we have to flush that out. I can't deny that part of me. I mean, we all come from, you know, a certain cultural experience, and we can't deny that. And deny that is to be really false to oneself, right? So what I'm doing as an anarchist and as someone who's Indian, who grows up in a specific context, and who at the same time doesn't want to deny one's cultural identity, is to try to promote these ideals within those specific contexts and to be relevant to people's day-to-day realities. And what does that mean in practice? Because we sort of underline this idea in practice to be anti-racist and anarchist, or to maintain one's cultural identity while maintaining those anti-authoritarian ideals. Well, it means very, very much a non-sectarian ethic, if people know where I'm coming from. The idea that we gotta be in rooms with people who we disagree with, because otherwise we're not gonna get anywhere in terms of promoting these ideas in very specific contexts, and I mean immigrant cultures within India, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't mean to speak in terms of being a missionary for anarchism, et cetera, but to be relevant means to get your hands dirty, so to speak, with national liberation struggles, with nationalistic struggles, and come to terms with them and not simply ignore them. How is one an anarchist? Just to give one specific example, I know there's someone here who could perhaps speak more about it, but how can one be an anarchist, say, in... how is one anarchist, more specifically, in, say, Nablus, in the West Bank, right? How relevant is it to speak about... you know, burning flags and getting rid of all national identity, when that is a basic part of how people in a context of imperialism and colonialism are asserting themselves. I really, like I said, I have to be honest, and I see no easy answers to these questions. And one of the goals of this, because the three of us wanted to put this on, and this is the second event that I've helped put on the same talk, is to encourage a dialogue, a debate, especially amongst so-called anarchists of color or people of color who identify with these ideas. And I just want to finish off by just reiterating some points that Helen mentioned, but I think are really important, and maybe are really important in this context here, where we're coming at, you know, there are a lot of different people lumped into the same room together. I really have to reiterate, but that we're not talking about peppering up this movement like just with, you know, people of color, or like Helen said, you know, like a Benetton ad for the anarchist movement. That's really, really important to not see it that way. That's the liberal take on it, this multiculturalism, right? Which you get a lot, and it's really condescending to recognize that there are oppressions in society, and anarchists recognize that, but class isn't the only one. We're really, really underlying another one that has to be acknowledged and be put front and center, and that is race. And it might seem obvious to a lot of people here, but it isn't. I remember being in a room where we're discussing a platform of a newspaper project, and it was like, hey, we're all anarchists here. Why do we have to talk about race? Well, yeah, we're all anarchists here, and you know, racism is a social construct, but it's a reality too, right? It's thrown in people's faces every day. And that has to be acknowledged. And of course, there's other forms of oppression that we're not talking about here, but are interrelated, such as gender and others. And I guess I'm just going to end off by the following, because I am committed, and I really believe profoundly in anarchist ideas and thoughts, and see them as not some sort of prescription, but the kind of world as sort of embodying the kind of world that we want to have. And they've been identified historically with Europe, right, with European thinkers. But I think it's also important to acknowledge the fact that they do exist in other cultural contexts. They're small, they're marginalized, as I mentioned before, but they do exist. And I think part of the project of Color of Anarchy, if it goes anywhere locally in Montreal or larger, is to suss out those currents. I don't want to talk about indigenous cultures and all of that. That's sort of an easy excuse, right, to say it exists in indigenous culture, therefore anarchy is this, you know, timeless thing. But I do want to talk about anarchism in China, well, not talk about, but acknowledge anarchism in China at the turn of the century, in Africa. They were small, but they were there, these ideas, and there were anarchist thinkers who were Indian and Chinese and African, and we sort of have to reclaim that aspect of anarchism. So with that, I'll turn over to Helen, who's... I'll talk about these questions too.
Does everyone understand English? Okay, we're still cool? Okay, so back to the questions. Okay, and like Jaggi, I've been thinking about these questions for a number of years. What does it mean to be anti-racist and anarchist in practice on the ground? Just as even before coming across anarchist ideas, for a long time I've been wondering how to actually be anti-racist in practice, and that's something that, you know, I'm learning more about every day and don't pretend to have an answer to right now. But I guess on the sort of general level, as James and Jaggi talked about it, I don't have a whole lot to add. I'm still grappling with the same questions that both of them mentioned in terms of how to put these things into practice. But I just wanted to give some reflections. So something that Jaggi and James and I discussed when we were talking about putting on this workshop is, can you positively assert a cultural identity? A discussion that happens often in anarchism is, well, we're against the state and nationalism helps support the state, so therefore nationalism is bad. But as Jaggi was saying, if all nationalism is bad, then, you know, does that mean that we're going to end up in a world, is our perfect, like, post-revolutionary world going to be one where we all are the same in all those ways that culture defines? We all speak the same language, we all, like, have a similar mode of dress, we all have similar thought process, a similar idea of our spirituality or atheism or religion, if we have one, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We interact in the same ways day to day. Or are we going to have cultural differences in anything like the way we know it today? You know, is Jaggi still going to get to be Indian and am I still going to get to be black after the revolution? Or do we just all get to be the same and does that mean we all get to be white? Because if so, I'm not in. So when we talk about a distinct cultural identity right now, before the revolution, working towards the revolution in our society and in our movement today, how do we assert our cultural identity? How do I go about being black? How does a Palestinian who's struggling in the West Bank go about being Palestinian? How does an East Timorese person go about being East Timorese without being nationalist in a way that, like, supports the state and isn't very anarchist? That's the question that we're trying to ask. I don't have an answer, but I hope that clears up the question. But so reflecting on that question, the three of us kind of came up with those three subpoints that I don't know if we wrote on there. Maybe we didn't. We discussed it in terms of how does one assert that cultural identity in, you know, an outright colonial situation where you've got a colonizing country coming in, you're on the territory of the colonized people, you know, they're colonized in all the, like, textbook ways that you could talk about. How do you assert that cultural context? Secondly, in maybe more of a neo-colonial situation where there's not a colonial master, but there's definitely imperialism going on. A people is on their territory, and there's another dominant culture coming in and subjugating them. And then thirdly, how do you assert that in more of an immigrant situation where there's people who are colonized, but it's like an internal colony, they're displaced. So, for example, the Filipino community in Montreal, where they're, like, not in the Philippines, they're, like, somewhere else. In thinking that through, I actually found that I think, and I'll throw this out for the discussion, I think that there's, you know, a lot to talk about there in terms of similarity than there is to talk about in terms of differences. There's definitely nuances and differences in how the assertion of cultural identity and these, like, the feeling of nationalism, how that plays out in those different contexts. You know, in the day and age of global capitalism, probably a lot of people in this room talk as much about fighting globalization, fighting neoliberalism, as we do about talk about fighting capitalism. Those lines are really fluid. I recently went back to my mother's home country, Suriname, in which I lived as a small child, and the kind of, like, assertion of cultural identity, which is a reaction against the kind of imperialism that you see there, is not that different than what I see it is for black people here in Montreal compared to, say, like, you know, 15, 16 years ago when I lived there. I think there was a big, big difference between there and in North America. Domination's being globalized, it's being made more uniform, and there's definitely still differences, but I'd like for people to think about, you know, the word the third world at home has been thrown around of late, and I think there really is sort of a growing potential for, like, unification in terms of, like, how that assertion of cultural identity plays itself out for people of color in different parts of the world. So that's one thing. But back to the question that's sort of been plaguing me on a more day-to-day basis, and maybe people can provide me with an answer in the discussion here, is how, as anarchists, do we actively play out anti-racism in different projects that I see anarchists involved in? One of the areas of work that I'm involved in myself is political prisoner support work. And because of the struggles that sort of met with the most state repression over the last 20 or 30 years, the vast majority of political prisoners here in, you know, northeastern North America that we're supporting are people of color coming out of anti-imperialist struggles, the vast majority of whom are very national or nationalistic imperialist struggles. So there's, like, Puerto Rican prisoners of war, there's people from the Black Liberation Army or the Republic of New Africa, groups like this who are clearly saying, we are a nation, we're fighting for national liberation, and after we're done, we want a state. So
you know, as anarchists, you know, the cop-out answer would be, well, screw you then, rot in jail. But, like, clearly as anarchists, we're not doing that. You know, we've got a whole lot of groups. You've got the Anarchist Black Cross Federation. You've got the Anti-Colonial Working Group here in Montreal that are doing the very opposite of that. And, you know, dialoguing with these political prisoners and finding actually that there's, like, way more similarity than there is difference. And, you know, I think a lot is being learned on both sides. So I guess where I'm at right now is, I don't know what you'd call that, like critical support, constructive engagement, whatever you want to call it. But like Jackie was saying, working, you know, in a non-condescending way, working in a non-sectarian way with people whose liberation is, like, tied to our own.
That was an excerpt from a workshop on anti-racism in the anarchist context recorded at the 2001 Montreal Anarchist Book Fair.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Spread it out equally.